a UK fan. Is that what you were made for? Some know from birth, like this little Neely Wildcat, who's adorable. And some reluctantly discover this a little later on in life. What about you? Does your hope lie in Pope? How would you describe worship? I'm guessing we would all agree that worship has something to do with what we value. Or maybe worship is our response to what we value. Each one of us values something, or maybe a couple of somethings, more than other things, more than anything else. And we can't help but do that. We can't help but value on things. It's almost as if we were made to do that. We were made to be a worshiper. People worship all kinds of things and ideas and people. You may worship your rights, the rights of women, the right of freedom, the rights of the unborn, the right to carry a gun, the right to say whatever you want to say. We might worship a career, an image. We might worship the thrill of an adventure. We may worship like the next big rush. Some people worship experiences, or a specific preacher, or a particular set of doctrine. The object of our worship often drives our decisions. How might you figure out what it is you worship? Well, you follow the trail. Where do you spend your time? What do you put energy into? Who gets and what gets your attention above most everything else? How do you spend your money? What do you donate your money to? Follow those questions to the end, and you'll gain a little insight into what it is that you worship. Worship is more about what we do than what we say. Worship is happening all the time. Back in the day before Oprah had her own network, she was on ABC every afternoon, and she built quite a loyal following. Would it be fair to say that at some level, people worshiped her? If she promotes your book or your product or your idea, man, you're golden. You're soon to become famous and wealthy. Exhibit A, Dr. Phil. Do we even know who Dr. Phil is without Oprah introducing him to America? Or try this, and I'll tread lightly, Taylor Swift. I'm guessing there might be a few Swifties in here this morning. Last football season, it seemed there were more cameras focused on Taylor at the Chiefs game than there was on the field where the game was going on. Her views moved the needle. And I bet you could find people who voted on November 5th for a candidate they believe she voted for because they believe that was her choice. Why do we crave something to worship, something to adore, something to lift up? Maybe a hint at the answer is found in Colossians 1, 16 and 17. For by him all things were created, things in heaven and on earth, visible and invisible. Whether thrones or powers or rulers or authorities, all things were created by him and for him. That last line is pretty meaningful. All things were created by him and for him. It sounds to me like Jesus has placed in us a desire which longs for him. We were made to connect with Jesus. If Pascal is right, if every person has been created with a God-shaped vacuum, if that's true, what we may be doing with this idea of worship is an attempt to fill the vacuum. We're looking for something to satisfy that longing. We need to attach to something, identify with something, a place to call home. So we go through life trying to find a fit. Trying to find something bigger, something more grand, something or someone to worship. I shared this verse from Psalm 145 a few weeks ago, and I want to read it again in verses 3 through 5. Great is the Lord and most worthy of praise. His greatness no one can fathom. One generation will commend your works to another. They will tell of your mighty acts. They will speak of the glorious splendor of your majesty, and I will meditate on your wonderful works. Part of the job as a leader in a church is to pay attention to generations, to trends and transitions in culture. And along with that comes the opportunity to help every generation realize that they are God's ambassadors advancing his kingdom through time. God's plan is for people in every generation to rise up and say, we have something to say, and we want to praise his name to the generation that comes. So that generation can rise up and say, we want to praise his name to the generation that comes. So that generation can stand up and say, and on it goes. Until Jesus comes, generations will keep on praising his name to another generation and telling of his mighty acts. God's purpose for us is to worship him and to make his name great in our lives. So this morning, I want to present a picture of what authentic worship is. And I want to begin with the Ark of the Covenant of God, the centerpiece of worshiping, of the centerpiece of worship among the nation of Israel. And you can find this story in 1 Samuel around chapters 4 through 6. Here's a worship principle that you can pull from this section of your Old Testament. Authentic worship reconnects us with the presence and the power of God. If worship is truly worship, then God and his people are miraculously and powerfully reconnected. King David was living in Jerusalem, the city of God, and he had a passion to retrieve the Ark of the Covenant so it would be among God's people in God's city. For 70 years, the Ark had not been with the people of God. It had been about 10 miles down the road. In the Old Testament, the Ark of the Covenant represented God's present resting glory among his people. David is unsettled with the fact that the symbol for God's presence is 10 miles down the road instead of with his people. So he said, I'm going to go get it. And he wants to reconnect the presence of God with the people of God. At this point in history, the Ark has been on an interesting journey, maybe more like a grand adventure. Let me go through some of the details for those of you who enjoy kind of seeing what's going on behind the scenes. At one point in a battle with the Philistines, Israel lost about 4,000 soldiers, and things didn't appear to be getting any better. So the elders of Israel have a brilliant idea. They say, let's go get the Ark and bring it to the battlefield. They think that will certainly win this fight for them. So Hophni and Phinehas, they were like the preacher's kids, Eli's sons, they bring the Ark out to the battlefield. The problem is, the people were putting all their confidence in the Ark and not necessarily in God. And that didn't sit well with God, so 30,000 Israelites soldiers die that day in battle. On top of that, the Philistines capture the Ark. The worst pagans on the planet now have the centerpiece of God's temple in their possession. And if that weren't bad enough, Eli's two sons are killed in battle. A messenger returns to Shiloh to tell Eli about what's going on. And you may remember what happens here. Eli is sitting on a city wall, waiting to hear news. He's 98 years old, he's blind, and apparently very obese. And the messenger tells Eli the news. You'll never believe what happened. We lost an incredible number of soldiers, and both of your sons have been killed. Now, that news doesn't seem to shake Eli all that much. His sons were awful. They were the worst spiritual leaders you can imagine, and they were in charge of the temple. And then the rest of the story comes out. The Philistines have captured the Ark of God. And when Eli hears that, he falls off the wall backwards and breaks his neck, and he dies. Eli's daughter-in-law, Phinehas' wife, is about to have a baby. The message comes to her, 30,000 people are dead. Your husband is dead. Your father-in-law is dead, and the Ark is gone. And right then, she goes into labor, and her baby boy is born. And before she dies, she names her son Ichabod, which means the glory of the Lord has departed. The glory is gone from his people. The Philistines, they have quite a treasure on their hands, so they decide to take the Ark on a victory tour. They have it scheduled for all the major cities. The first stop is Ashdod. And they put the Ark in the temple of their god, Dagon, as a way of saying, look what we have. And they're selling T-shirts, you know, with victory tour schedule on the back and foam number one fingers, you know, on the side. And an interesting thing happens. After leaving the Ark in the temple of Dagon all night long, they come back the next morning and their big idol, Dagon, has fallen on its face. So they prop their god back up. They don't know what happened. And when they come back the next morning, Dagon has fallen over again, but for some extra emphasis, Dagon has no hands nor head on the second day. They have been mysteriously severed in the night, and the Philistines say, we may have a problem on our hands. The next stop on the victory tour is Gath, and they pull in with the ark, and they say, look what we stole from the Israelites. However, it doesn't take long for a plague of tumors to break out in that city. And then the ark was moved to Ekron, and the people of Ekron protest, saying, what do you have against us? Are you trying to kill us? You know, we don't want that thing. And every city they go to, all kinds of pestilence breaks out. Nobody wants the ark to come to their town. Tumors, chaos, death. Finally, the Philistines admit, this is not going how we expected. We got to give this thing back. So they build a brand new cart, and they get two of their best-looking cows. And this is the funny part. They attach some parting gifts to the side of the ark. And not just any old parting gifts. These are really unique. 5 gold tumors and 5 gold rats as a representation of the experience of possessing the ark. And they smack the cows on the backside, and away they go. Well, the Israelites retrieve the ark at a place called Beth Shemesh. And as you would guess, the Israelites are pretty pumped about getting the ark back. They've been through some tough times. They've been ridiculed all over the countryside while the ark was on the victory tour. And when they get it back, they chop up the cart, they build an altar, and they sacrifice the cows. We aren't told what happens to the gold rats and tumors. Everything is going smoothly until someone has this great thought, which everybody agrees with. They think, the Philistines sent the ark back, but I bet they took the stuff out of it. So they take the lid off. And what happens when you take the lid off the ark? We've seen that in the movie, right? Bad things happen. That great idea cost them the lives of 70 men. And in the wake of sadness and loss that day, the people ask, who is this God? And what will we do with him? And when was the last time you asked that question? Who is this God we worship? And how can we dare approach him? The Israelites don't know what to do with this ark, so they take it to Abinadab's house. Now here's a question for you. Let's say it was your door that was knocked on. You know, good afternoon, we've scoured the countryside for a worthy household to provide safe haven to the Ark of the Covenant of God. And surprise, you're the lucky homeowner. And you say, what an honor. Bring it on in. Set it right over there to my nightstand. I'm already an insomniac. Maybe I could be paranoid too. I'll just put my living will in it. How's that? So the Ark stayed at Abinadab's house for about 70 years until David said the presence of God should be with the people of God. So David took about 30,000 men. That's half of Kroger Field. And he took them to Beth Shemesh to retrieve the ark. And David found it right where it was left. Abinadab hasn't dared move it from that spot. David, he has a passion. He wants the world to know that the glory of God rests on the Israelites. Regardless of how or when or where we worship, we would be doing well to have David's same passion. He wants anyone who knows the Israelites to know that the presence of God is among them. And when someone walks into here, into this room, in the middle of our worship time, we want them to see and to feel and to know that God's presence is in this place. When someone walks into our home, we want them to feel the presence of God. I want them to sense something different about my place. That's what the Apostle Paul is shooting for in his words to the Corinthians in 1 Corinthians 14:25, when someone walks into your worship assembly, the goal for them to say is God is really among you. So how seriously do we value that goal? To what lengths are you willing to move to honor that goal for the person you're sitting next to, or to someone who's in this church business, you know, kind of new to this church business, who just walks in the door? Does your expression, your posture, your attitude, communicate to someone watching that being in God's presence is not only an honor, but the very purpose for which you were created? What is at the core as a community of God's people? If you strip everything away, what is it we were made for? Paul writes it this way in Acts 17, in him we live and move and have our being. The purpose of our worship is to connect with God's presence and his power. If that's our core value, then when people come around us, a question we'll hear from them is, who is this God? You know, there are lots of ways to ask that question. Like, why are you being so kind to me? Why do you want to get to know me? Why do you care about what I think? Why do you care about what I'm going through? Why are you different? First, we've got to ask that question ourselves before others will be led to ask it. Who is this God? You know, on campus, that's the question Trace and Jenna want people to be asking as they come into touch with Cats for Christ. And as high school students find their ways to our youth ministry, Jeremy wants those new students to ask the same question. Who is this God? And why are you so different? As people lean into this question and we respond, we have the opportunity to lead the next generation into his presence so they can lead the next generation into his presence, and on it goes. Another result of authentic worship is that it reorders our priorities around God's interest. It seems to me that spiritually focused events are judged by the worship, which boils down to the quality of music. Whether it's a big conference or weekly church assembly or devotional or Bethmore conference, whatever it is, you know, in January, our college students and our high school seniors will head down to Orange Beach for the Gulf Coast Getaway that's been going on for a long time. In times of worship at this event, the times of worship at this event are inspiring. I mean, they're energizing. It's about 700 to 800 college students in, you know, just in one room. And the people walk away sometimes saying, the worship time was incredible. But hear this, worship is incredible if it reconnects us with God, and when we get reconnected with God, it reorders our world. Worship is not incredible unless our lives are changed. What joy is it to see it happen among these students, like at the Gulf Coast Getaway deal, energizing, thoughtful worship followed by changed lives back home on campus. So David goes back to Abinadab's house to retrieve the ark. His passion is to reconnect the people of God with the presence of God. And he has a brilliant idea. He says, let's build our own cart, let's find our own cows, and bring the ark back to Jerusalem. So here they come with the ark on a cart. And what happens next? The cart's unsettled. A guy named Uzzah reaches to stabilize it. Next thing you know, Uzzah is a goner. And the question emerges again, who is this God? This time, Obed-Edom draws the short straw. And the message to Mr. Edom is, we're putting this in your house until we figure out how to deal with this God. God blesses Obed so much that word gets back to David. And David says, let's try this again. You can say a lot about David, even some not so good things. But above all, David is a worshiper. He loves to worship. So David goes back to Obed-Edom's house, and this time around, he puts the ark on poles. Do you know why? Because when God designed the ark, he made it to be transported on poles, not carts. Authentic worship reorders the way we do things. We begin to do things God's way. So they put the poles through the rings, which God designed for that purpose, and they begin to carry on poles the ark of the covenant of God back to Jerusalem, the city of God. Now here's a question. Would you have wanted to be chosen for that job, that detail? 30,000 dead at Shiloh, 70 dead at Beth Shemesh. 3 months ago, Uzzah loses his life abruptly. I would not want to be signed up for ark transport duty. Can you imagine? They've run the poles through the ark. They got a few guys standing there, and they're holding the poles, and they take the first step. It's like, okay, that felt all right. And then they take the second step. And then they take the third step, and they're still breathing. And they say to God, well, they stop, they put the ark down, they sacrifice an ox and a calf, and they worship this God who's beyond their comprehension, and they say, thank you, God, for not killing us. So here's a quick application to take with you. How many steps do you take between your moments of worship? David says, God, in light of who you are, holy, almighty, And the fact that I'm continually messing up, I don't want to take six steps without stopping for a moment to worship you. Here's a quote from Louis Giglio, whose message on this topic has really kind of helped me think through this well. He says, "So they carry the ark back to Jerusalem on poles, which was exactly what God intended all along for the ark. Worship, when it is authentic, changes us. It causes people to stop sleeping with their boyfriend or girlfriend. It causes people to stop looking at pornography. It causes people to stop loving culture. It motivates us to give our money away. It causes people to stop with the excuses, the compromises, the mediocrity. Authentic worship causes us to reorder our priorities and start doing things God's way." You know, I'm a firm advocate of adjusting worship style to honor different generations of believers in an attempt to connect them with God's presence and power. Gregory has done that well in his role as our worship leader for so many years, and I appreciate his attention to this need. However, if the worshipers' lives are not becoming more aligned with God's interests and purposes, the worship is not authentic, no matter how genuine it may feel. And Gregory or Keith or Dan, they can't do that for us. That's a choice each of us has to make. A final principle of authentic worship is this: authentic worship releases our passion for the glory of God. I'm sure it is quite a long journey if they keep stopping every six steps with the ark. That'd take a while to go 10 miles. Psalm 24 is a song believed to have been written on this occasion as the ark comes back to Jerusalem. "Who may ascend the hill of the Lord? Who may stand in his holy place?" Do you remember Dagon wasn't able to do that? "He who has clean hands and a pure heart, who does not lift his soul to an idol or swear by what is false. He will receive blessing from the Lord and vindication from God his Savior. Such is the generation of those who seek him, who seek your face, O God of Jacob. Lift up your heads, O you gates. Be lifted up, you ancient doors, that the King of glory may come in. Who is this King of glory? The Lord strong and mighty, the Lord mighty in battle." That's the song they sing on their way into the city, bringing the ark back home. And as they get closer and closer to Jerusalem, the excitement keeps growing. And the Ark of the Covenant of God is soon to be back among the people of God. And for all of us who grew up with a non-dancing theology, this one's hard to get around. David strips down to his ephod, and he dances, and he dances, and he dances. And he dances until the cows come home, and then he sacrifices them. Somehow, this encounter releases in him a passion to celebrate before his God. He just couldn't contain himself. And I can't help but wonder if God hasn't placed that same passion in each of his followers. It's just that we may not have been uncorked yet. I say that because we can certainly be passionate in other areas. It seems we have in worship a governor on our passion sometimes. At Rupp Arena, or at an 8-year-old Little League baseball game, or a great sale at Dillard's, we let the passion flow. We know how to do that. But when it comes to worship, we're just a little more careful. David isn't cut from that cautious kind of fabric. He just can't hold back. And don't forget, David is a man after God's own heart, and he dances before the Lord. And David's wife, Michal, she doesn't appreciate his little exhibition. And she says, "What you're doing out there today, David, you embarrassed me." And his response is great. He says this to her: "God has chosen me. He has handpicked me. And I'm going to celebrate." I'd like to let you in on something this morning. If you make a choice to be a worshiper on campus, in your high school, in the marketplace, people will wonder, and some will even ask, "What in the world are you doing?" You will stick out if you follow God. And that's not just true for students. It's true for those of you who spend your days working in a hospital, teaching in a classroom, somewhere tucked away in a cubicle or in the corner office with all the windows. It's true for those of you who are especially intentional in your parenting. You will be different. Even with some parents you go to church with, you'll be different. But you can say, I've been chosen by the creator of the world to be on his team, and his choice changes everything for me. Whenever I preach, I try to share invitations with you which are specifically related to the text that we've studied. And I have a couple to share with you this morning as we finish up. The most obvious invitation is to stay connected or to reconnect with God through creating space for authentic worship. One of those spaces might be in this room, or it might be in your car on the way to work, or it might be on your porch in the morning. We all need a space to keep connected to our Creator. Don't take too many steps between your times of worship. Another invitation is to worship genuinely, authentically, the kind of worship which inspires life change. And in Psalm 145, we have an invitation to bring along the next generation of worshipers. David's worship inspired others to worship. And that's the invitation to all of us this morning, an invitation to experience authentic worship. Let's stand together and sing.